Welcome back to the second half of the Making Waves show. This is Steve Diamond with Between Iraq and a Hard Place, One Step Towards Real Peace in the Middle East. What's happening right now with the UN-brokered ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah may, and I emphasize may, stop the fighting for now, but does nothing to address the underlying causes of this conflict, including the continuing oppression of the Palestinians and the nuclear apartheid of the Middle East. The terms of the ceasefire leave the water-rich Sheba farms in de facto Israeli control, likely to provoke continuing Hezbollah attacks, and call on Israel to only stop, quote, all offensive military operations. Israel considers the entire war, including systematic bombing of Lebanon's civilian infrastructure, to be defensive in nature. We can certainly expect Israel's occupation forces to react, and probably overreact, to the threatened Hezbollah attacks over Sheba farms. Strangely enough, the ceasefire resolution seems to call on Hezbollah to unilaterally disarm in South Lebanon. Even Hezbollah's dedication to national unity in Lebanon might not be enough to bring them to give up their weapons and resistance in the face of continuing Israeli occupation and military action. Then there's the question of how respectful of the United Nations Israel is willing to be. A few weeks ago, Israel spent an entire day bombing a clearly marked UN observer bunker, despite continuous desperate phone calls from UN diplomats to stop the assault. Kofi Annan called it an, quote, apparently deliberate targeting by Israel. In the ensuing controversy, it has been suggested that Israel would never intentionally attack the United Nations. Yet that is exactly what Israel promised to do shortly thereafter, to attack UN workers if they dared to repair critical civilian infrastructure in Lebanon. The shameful fact is that it would be fairly easy for the world community to resolve this conflict once and for all, within the framework of the United Nations. Ideally, Israel should respect Article 13 of the UN Declaration of Human Rights and allow the 600 to 900,000 Palestinian refugees and their descendants to return to their homes, or to the rubble where their homes once stood, to peacefully and democratically coexist with Jews. But if this was done, Israel would no longer be a Jewish state, as Zionism requires. Thus, Israel's policy of ethnic cleansing of Palestinians is simultaneously a war crime comparable to the Holocaust, and an integral part of Zionism. Thus, the cycle of mass murder continues. Ironically, Palestine has a long history of Jews and Arabs peacefully coexisting. In the face of endless military defeat and denial of their basic rights on all sides, the Palestinians' only real future is peaceful coexistence with Israel, and most of them know it. But as long as Israel keeps Palestinian villages as prisons and sees no law protecting Arabs that a Jew is bound to respect, the violent resistance to Israel will continue. Thus, Israel justifies its expansionism and disproportionate use of force, and the U.S. uses Israel as its peace-loving, democratic bastion of Western civilization to control the flow of oil and keep everyone in the region buying our primary export, weapons. It doesn't have to be this way. We could end our dependence on foreign oil. We could stop arming Israel. And most importantly, we could help make the Middle East far more peaceful and just for a tiny fraction of what we are now deficit spending on defense to bully the world into doing things our way. The fact is that Israel is a Jewish state that will go to any extreme to maintain its existence as a Jewish majority. Given the trauma inflicted on the Jewish people during the Holocaust, their wish for a safe homeland is understandable, but safety cannot be secured through brute force. The German government eventually paid $90 billion as compensation for the forced relocation, forced labor, and extermination of Jews and other groups during the Holocaust. This money, and the annual $6 billion in economic and military aid from the United States, contribute to the harsh economic and military disparity we've seen throughout the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's time for the U.S. to become a truly fair arbiter, or to allow the U.N. the power to do so in the interests of us all. If the Palestinians had similar financial support, it would be far more realistic for the Israelis and Palestinians to treat each other as equals. The U.S. should immediately cut its military budget in half, currently about $663 billion, and pay $90 billion to the Palestinians, on behalf of our client state, Israel, to compensate them for the loss of their property and to help them establish a viable homeland, living peacefully side by side with Israel. This might not completely end the threat from Al-Qaeda, but it would severely curtail its propaganda efforts and would go a long way toward ending our expanding conflicts with Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and Syria. The so-called War on Terror could essentially end next week and the U.S. could avert the economic disaster we're headed towards due to deficit military spending and sky-high fuel prices. It's in the interests of everyone on Earth, except the fundamentalist neoconservative oil barons running this country. You can find that column on nhindymedia.org. On the right bar, called Between a Rack and a Hard Place, with pictures and full links.
Worship's at an altar, like a stagnant pool. When he sees his reflection, he's fulfilled. Man is opposed to fair play. He wants it all and he wants it his way. There's a woman on my block. And she sits there facing the hill. She says, who is gonna take away his license to kill? She says, who's gonna take away his license to kill? She says, who is gonna take away?
That was License to Kill by Richie Havens. Next, we have commentary by Jav Parrish.
An exercise in power. This is Jav Parrish. I'm finally back home in Seattle after a 7,000-mile round-trip road journey to Maine and back. The return half, fueled by all the hot air flowing from national commentary in the wake of Ned Lamont's victory over Joe Lieberman in the Connecticut primary. The Ned Lamont challenge would not have happened, let alone succeeded, without voter dissatisfaction over the Iraq War and Lieberman's relentless cheerleading for it. 60% of Americans and an overwhelming majority of Democrats want the U.S. to end its involvement in Iraq, yet few serious leaders from either party in Washington reflect that public consensus. It's hard to find senators who will even say that Iraq has become, as in the title of Thomas E. Rick's new book, a fiasco. For over 3 years now, the operative mode in our nation's capital regarding Iraq has been denial. With a few honorable exceptions, Republicans have mimicked their president's rose-colored stay-the-course mantras, while Democrats, minus hawks like Lieberman, have preferred to talk about something, anything else. Lamont's win suddenly presents a very real political threat to all those folks' cozy no-bid contracts, pork-laden emergency appropriations, and country club games of Stratego. But voter anger in Connecticut and elsewhere isn't just about a war sold with lies and executed with cruelty and incompetence. It's also about the refusal of our elected representatives to do anything about it once it became obvious that it was all going awry. And it's about their continuing bipartisan refusal to do anything even when the public came to a majority conclusion that the whole thing was a misbegotten mess. And even that wouldn't resonate so strongly if it weren't so reminiscent of government failures dacked on our nation's health care crises, the ballooning deficit, the catastrophe that is public education, and on and on. In other words, Ned Lamont's victory wasn't just an indictment of war policy. It was also an indictment of the complete lack of responsiveness and accountability that has characterized both the executive branch and Congress, both parties, for years. D.C. business as usual has come to mean not dealing with the nation's problems by trying to find solutions, however flawed, but instead feeding a bipartisan corporate oligarchy while lying to the public and hoping to distract us from our problems with fake issues like gay marriage, flag burning, or the ludicrously renamed death tax. That is why Ned Lamont's victory scared the permaclass running our nation's capital. That small, incestuous circle of legislators, lobbyists, think tanks, and corporate donors knows it can only be taken down in one way, by the will of the voters. And while come November, incumbents will still have every advantage this year, we now know, each of us, in every state and every congressional district, that our local D.C. business-as-usual hack can be beaten. If it doesn't happen this November, there's plenty of time for 2008. That's why all the hysteria and hot air from Beltway people who know better. It's not that they don't recognize that voters, properly motivated, can bring down this whole corrupt charade of corporate democracy. It's that they don't want you to recognize it. Because if you, which is to say we, understand that the ultimate electoral power really does belong to us, we're capable of ending a lot more than just the war in Iraq. From KBCS, for the Pacifica Network, this is Jav Parrish.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The Federal Communications Commission has sent letters of inquiry to the owners of 77 television stations in 34 states that were caught earlier this year attempting to pass off video news releases from major corporations as legitimate journalism. Diane Farsetta, senior researcher at the Center for Media and Democracy, co-authored the investigative report that spurred the probe, which included dozens of on-air clips from stations caught in the act. She says the violations of public disclosure rules are clear and penalties are in order.
The FCC needs to fine some stations at least, if not take other actions against them.
Other actions could range from an official FCC admonishment attached to an offending TV station's license file to outright license revocation and even criminal proceedings. Although this is the first ever FCC investigation of its kind, Farsetta is cautiously optimistic that the agency will do the right thing.
So I do know that we're up against some deep-pocketed interests, but this is a flagrant breach of current law. So, I mean, I think this is sort of a make or break point for the FCC, that either they enforce the laws on the books or they cease to be taken seriously.
When CMD's report was first released in April, many in the TV news business first tried to ignore it and then downplayed its findings as the chronicle of a few lazy reporters. But the number of stations involved in the VNR scam, outed after a sampling of less than 1% of all VNRs in circulation, suggests the problem of fake news remains pervasive, and Farsetta says they've got more evidence to prove it.
We're going to go public with our new findings within the next month or two, but I can just broadly say that of all the attention that's been paid to this and all of the strong actions that the FCC has taken, TV stations still haven't gotten the message.
While all of the video news releases identified in the CMD study came from corporate sponsors, there haven't been any recent reviews of the use of government VNRs without proper disclosure. However, we do know that things are still a bit shady in that scene. Recently, it came to light that Deputy Assistant Labor Secretary Karen Czarnecki has been moonlighting on TV talk shows identified only as a conservative strategist. The Labor Department's ethics advisors have signed off on the FaceTime since Czarnecki never purports to speak on behalf of the department, though she does get paid for her appearances on public TV programs.
The United States Supreme Court has agreed to hear a challenge to an antitrust lawsuit filed against the nation's largest telephone companies. AT&T, Bell South, Quest, and Verizon are being sued for colluding to carve up the country into specific geographic territories where one company would dominate. At issue in this particular challenge is whether the standard of collusion alleged in the lawsuit is high enough to permit proper litigation. A large segment of corporate America has already filed briefs with the High Court, pleading for it to throw out the case. Oral arguments could be heard as early as October. And although the mergers of SBC with AT&T and Verizon with MCI have been approved by regulators, a federal judge conducting a final review is questioning whether the conditions of those deals are good enough to promote competition in a national marketplace for phone service that has now just three dominant players. He's apparently concerned that regulators did not conduct enough diligent oversight of the transactions. Though it's unlikely the judge could reverse the mergers, he could impose more stringent conditions on them. And rulings of that sort could be used as precedent in future strategic corporate marriages, such as AT&T's planned $67 billion buyout of Bell South.
In related news, a federal judge in Detroit has declared the National Security Agency's warrantless wiretapping of phone and internet traffic to be unconstitutional and ordered it be halted immediately. It's the first ruling of its kind involving several lawsuits filed across the country challenging the growing security state. Additionally, 17 lawsuits filed against AT&T, Bell South, and Verizon for their alleged collusion in the spy scheme have been consolidated into a single case. It will be heard in the Northern District of California, where the first of the 17 cases was filed, and where a judge recently blocked a government attempt to have the case dismissed on state secrecy grounds. The consolidation decision is also considered a win by privacy advocates. The phone companies and federal government wanted the cases consolidated in a court in Washington, D.C., whose rulings have been historically favorable to government and corporate litigants. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
You're listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. And now for Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Stephen Zunitz, Middle East editor with Foreign Policy in Focus, who assesses the winners and losers in the aftermath of the month-long Israeli offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Journalist and author John Ross, who reports from Mexico on the continuing widespread protests demanding a full recount of the July 2nd presidential election. And Jacob Hacker, a professor of political science at Yale University, who asserts that Ned Lamont's primary victory over three-term U.S. Senator from Connecticut Joseph Lieberman represents a realignment in American party politics. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Escalating violence in Sri Lanka has left a four-year ceasefire between government troops and Tamil Tiger rebels in tatters. In mid-August, Pakistan's top envoy to Sri Lanka survived a bomb attack in the capital city of Colombo. The ambassador was not hurt, but three people died in the attack. A few days earlier, Sri Lankan fighter jets bombed rebel positions in the northeast of the Asian island nation. The government faced intense criticism for bombing an orphanage that the Tamil rebels claimed killed 61 children. The Sri Lanka government says it was bombing a Tamil rebel training camp. Tensions have grown over the last month after Tamil troops shut off the water flow to farmers in a region that borders zones controlled by the government and the Tamil Tigers. As the water flow to mostly pro-government farmers opened up, Sri Lankan jets bombed nearby rebel positions, leading to more criticism of the government by outside monitors. The Tamil Tigers, officially known as the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, have waged a 21-year war for an ethnically independent state. The thwarted terrorist plot against London to New York airliners forced travelers to toss out water bottles and liquid personal care products from carry-on luggage. According to Mother Jones magazine, air travelers face more mundane threats to their safety, specifically the outsourcing of routine airline maintenance and new forms of self-regulation among aircraft manufacturers. In just one example, the FAA turned over management of 58 flight service stations to Lockheed Martin. The giant defense contractor then shut down half of the inspection stations. In the 1990s, a robust period for the airlines, errors in airplane maintenance, often performed by small subcontractors, led to major accidents and loss of life. In 1996, a value jet plane caught fire over the Everglades after oxygen containers mistakenly placed on board by a service contractor caught fire. The ensuing crash killed 110 passengers. A recent report by the Department of Transportation Inspector General questioned the wisdom of FAA's hands-off attitude. The report also found airlines now farmed out half of their aircraft maintenance to private contractors, a jump of 20% since the mid-1990s. White extremist groups are increasingly trying to sell their anti-Semitic message to Muslim audiences. In July, William Baker, former president of the right-wing U.S. Populist Party and backer of David Duke's 1988 presidential campaign bid, was set to speak to a number of mainstream Muslim audiences in Canada. The appearances were canceled as word of his extremist ties spread. August Kreese of the racist Aryan Nations told Toronto-based Maclean's magazine, U.S. Nazis don't consider Islamic people the enemy. We want them to join us. In his defense, Baker says he has quit the U.S. Populist Party and was not aware the party platform called for repeal of the U.S. Civil Rights Act, which bans racial segregation in public places. The Populist Party is also home to a number of Holocaust deniers, like Willis Carto of the Institute for Historic Review. Yet Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center does not see a strong bond building between Muslims and white hate groups. As Potok observed, when all is said and done, for American neo-Nazis, Muslims are, quote, mud people. It's hard to get beyond that. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
Fragile UN-brokered ceasefire took hold across Lebanon and Israel on August 13th after 34 days of war, which killed an estimated 1,100 Lebanese civilians, 41 Israeli civilians, and 118 soldiers. The numbers of Hezbollah fighters killed ranges from an Israeli report of 400, while Hezbollah says only 68 died in battle. Both Israel and Hezbollah claimed victory, but Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert clearly did not achieve his stated goal of destroying Hezbollah's military capability. Hezbollah's leader, Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, proclaimed in a post-ceasefire TV address, "We emerged from the battle with our heads high, and our enemy is the one who is defeated." The conflict, which devastated Lebanon's infrastructure, enhanced Hezbollah's status as heroes in the Arab street, and further damaged the standing of Israel and the U.S. across much of the rest of the world. It could take several weeks to implement the UN ceasefire agreement, which calls for the deployment of an international force of 15,000 UN peacekeepers, along with 15,000 Lebanese army troops in southern Lebanon. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Stephen Zunes, Middle East editor with Foreign Policy and Focus, who assesses the winners and losers in the aftermath of the Israeli offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon.
The Israeli attacks on Lebanon apparently had been planning for at least 3 years. The San Francisco Chronicle and other American and Israeli papers had revealed that the Israelis had actually briefed officials in Washington as far back as this fall about their plans. In the May 23rd summit between Ehud Olmert and President Bush, it was reported that President Bush strongly encouraged Israel to attack Lebanon and attack Syria as well. The Israelis were smart enough to decide not to take on Syria, but they were waiting for an excuse to launch a full-scale assault on Lebanon. They found that excuse when a militiaman from Hezbollah crossed over to the Israeli border and seized two Israeli soldiers, apparently in hopes that they would trade them for three Lebanese citizens that Israel had seized in Lebanon sometime earlier, and do some kind of prisoner exchange, similar to what they had done a number of times in the past. But unbeknownst to Hezbollah, Israel was waiting for an excuse for a U.S.-backed full-scale assault on Lebanon, which then started with bombings of a number of Lebanese cities, the airports, port facilities, much of the country's civilian infrastructure. Hezbollah retaliated by firing rockets into Israeli cities, killing a number of Israeli civilians. Israel began incursions into Lebanon. There was heavy fighting. The Israelis did not do as well as they expected. They got a first-class army, which is good against conventional forces, but against the guerrilla army, they're having a lot more trouble. The United States, for weeks, blocked the United Nations from imposing a ceasefire, egging Israel on. The U.S. Congress, in an overwhelming bipartisan vote, defended Israel's attacks, denied that they were killing large numbers of civilians, and basically gave wholehearted support to President Bush's policies. But eventually, the fact that Israel was not succeeding in crushing Hezbollah and ongoing pressure from the international community led to this ceasefire agreement.
Now, I believe the head of Hezbollah in Lebanon is claiming victory in that his organization, his political and military organization, withstood the brunt of the Israeli offensive against them. So who comes out on top? Does it matter? And what are the short-term and the long-term repercussions for the myriad of conflicts in the Middle East?
Well, the clear losers were the Lebanese and Israeli civilians that died as a result of this totally unnecessary conflict. The United States certainly lost credibility in the international community, has been severely damaged by supporting Israel and committing what Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, and virtually every government in the world recognizes war crimes. And Hezbollah has come out stronger, though they lost some men and lost some equipment. Their popularity in Lebanon is an all-time high. They got 85% approval from all communities in Lebanon, including the Maronite Christians, who have traditionally been very much opposed to Hezbollah's activities. They've gotten support from throughout the Arab and Islamic world, and so they seem to have come out on top of this thing a lot stronger. This is indeed what many of us predicted at the beginning, but that didn't stop not just the Bush administration, but both the Republicans and Democrats from supporting Israel's attacks anyway. And so I think maybe they mistakenly thought they were being friends with Israel by supporting this, but as even many Israelis were pointing out, this is a very, very bad news for Israel, which has not only lost scores of soldiers and civilians, but has increased its isolation and hostility towards it in the international community.
What's next? Do you think this ceasefire will hold, or there are many other flashpoints, certainly, that both sides could find themselves slipping back into a conflict, don't you think?
Yes, I mean, it is possible. bad news for Lebanon, of course, is Hezbollah's popularity is gained, and being a democratic country, it raises the possibility that Hezbollah will become a stronger political force, even if they do disarm their militia, as they should, as they need to. Their political party, which does have a very hardline extremist reactionary ideology, is going to gain. But I think that there's a decent chance that the things on the Lebanon-Israeli border will go back to the status quo ante, which is a tense peace. Certainly, I don't think things will be any better, but I don't think they'll necessarily be a lot worse either. The main issue, of course, continues to be Israel's ongoing occupation and colonization and repression in the West Bank. There are attacks in civilian areas in Gaza Strip. But until there's a viable Palestinian state alongside Israel, I don't think there's much prospects for peace.
That was Stephen Zunes, Middle East editor with Foreign Policy in Focus. Visit their website at www.fpif.org. Zunes is a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco and author of the book Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. More than 6 weeks after Mexico's disputed July 2nd presidential election, thousands of protesters continued to occupy the streets of Mexico City, demanding a full recount of each of the 41 million votes cast. The Federal Election Institute had unofficially declared Felipe Calderón, candidate of the Conservative National Action Party, the winner, with a slim 243,000 vote margin. Proclaiming the election tainted by fraud, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, candidate of the center-left Party of Democratic Revolution, rallied his mostly poor supporters in giant protests in Mexico City's Zócalo or Central Square to demand a vote-by-vote recount. But after hearing evidence of ballot tampering and other irregularities from López Obrador's camp, Mexico's seven-judge Federal Election Tribunal issued a decision rejecting a full recount, but ordered a new tally of 12,000 precincts, just under 10% of all votes cast. The recount was completed August 13th, the results of which must be publicly released by August 31st. A president must be declared by September 6th, or the election has to be annulled. Frustrated with the process, López Obrador and tens of thousands of his supporters encamped in tent cities on major boulevards around the capital have engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience, including blocking entrances to government offices, U.S.-owned banks, and taking over toll booths. A scuffle between police and López Obrador supporters in front of Mexico's Congress on August 14th devolved into a melee of stone throwing and the firing of tear gas. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist and author John Ross, who has covered Mexico for several decades. Reached in Mexico City, Ross reports on the rising tensions in the still unresolved presidential election.
On August 8th, the court of last resort, what is called the Trife here, which has to confirm a president by September 5th, refused the request of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the left-wing candidate that feels that he has won the election, to open all the ballot boxes, but did order a partial recount of a little less than 10% of the ballot boxes in 26 separate states, and actually with some focus on states where the party of Felipe Calderón, the right-wing candidate, had run up a big and suspect majority. And that recount lasted for 5 days. Untold numbers of anomalies were discovered. Hundreds of ballot boxes were found to have been ripped open, the seals removed from them, and the contents contaminated. Sometimes the ballots were spilled out on the floors. These were in warehouses that were protected by the military. Sometimes there were no votes inside the ballot boxes, just a tally sheet. And great numbers of votes, thousands of votes, were lost by Felipe Calderón, and López Obrador didn't pick up those votes, but they were subtracted from Calderón's totals and picked up approximately, in some areas, 12, in some areas, 15 votes a ballot box. Now, López Obrador had to get to around 24,000 votes because these were a tenth of the ballot boxes, and Calderón's lead, as awarded him by the Federal Electoral Institute, was 240,000 votes, so a tenth of those would be 24,000. If indeed you extrapolated that, they'd be in a flat-footed tie, and then the judges would have to open all the ballot boxes. There are just enormous irregularities. There are tens of thousands of ballots missing that are counted but do not exist in reality. Almost a million ballots are missing. They were sent to the ballot boxes, but they were not registered in the ballot boxes. And one of the judges at the Trife suggested that people had taken them home as souvenirs. So you can imagine what has developed out of this recount. It appears that, you know, a systematic fraud, both down below, moving one or two or three ballots is all you need to do in each ballot box in order to give Felipe Calderon this victory, in addition to the manipulation that occurred on the computers. All of this information has gone to the Trife. They're not revealing any totals. They have to validate the election, so they will take this information into respect. They could annul entire districts. Indeed, if they annul enough of those districts, we'd cancel Calderon's lead and give the victory to Lopez Obrador. Having said that, I think that no one is predicting that this is going to be a happy ending here. The judiciary in this country, and indeed the judges that supervise this stuff, many of them are, you know, not exactly figures of probity.
Just give us a few details on the protests that are being planned by Lopez Obrador and his supporters over the next month.
September 1st will be the day of the State of the Union message. They intend to circle the Congress of the country. That was not too successful today. On September 15th is the night, you know, that the Mexican Independence night, or the eve of it, and it's the famous Grito, where the president always comes to the Zocalo and speaks from the balcony and you know, gives the Grito of Viva Mexico. Well, this year he's not going to be able to do that because Lopez Obrador's people have the Zocalo, so, you know, they've got that sewed up and they've asked the Fox to go to someplace else. September 16th, Independence Day, is traditionally a military parade. I mean, a big-scale military parade here. And Lopez Obrador has called a National Democratic Convention, invited people from all over Mexico, everyone from all over Mexico to come to the Zocalo for this convention, you know, the beginning of 6 years of opposition. And they've got the Zocalo. So, you know, there's a natural-born confrontation with the military. And then, you know, we go all the way to December 1st when, in fact, Calderon would receive the sash from his predecessor from Fox. And you can be sure that's kind of Armageddon here. That will be the day that the PRD and Lopez Obrador will throw everything that they can at trying to prevent this from happening.
Is there a real danger of violence, do you think, as this end game of the election, the July 2nd election, comes to a head?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think that's the subtext of what's going on. These are people that are really angry, and, you know, they have a model before them, 1988, where Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas sent them home to their house, you know, and they're not going to let that happen. And Lopez Obrador is very conscious of what happened in 1988. You know, he's not going to be a person that sold the people out. So, you know, I've been with Andrés Manuel on a number of occasions. It watched him talk up nonviolence. This has been a scenario that we've seen before, specifically in 96 in the strike of farmers against the petroleum platforms in the state of Tabasco. But, you know, whether or not, you know, he's going to be able to do that, I think is today's scuffle in front of the Congress, I think, is an indication of much more to come. And indeed, the people that were scuffling were not just rank and file people. These were the new legislatures in the Congress that will be sworn in September 1st. So if it happens on that level, you can be assured that there's going to be plenty of scuffling down below. After the election was stolen from Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas in 1988, hundred members of the PRD of Cárdenas' party were killed in political violence between 1988 and 1991. And the gates of hell are open here, man.
That was journalist and author John Ross. Read Ross's articles online at www.counterpunch.org. Ross's forthcoming book, to be published in October, is titled Zapatistas, Making Another World Possible. The historic defeat of three-term Senator and 2000 Vice Presidential candidate Joseph Lieberman by political newcomer Ned Lamont in Connecticut's Democratic primary August 8th has generated international headlines. Losing by 4 percentage points, Lieberman vowed to run in the general election as an independent, or, as he pledged in his non-concession speech, an independent Democrat. Although the Democratic Party and almost all elected Democrats in Connecticut and around the nation, with the exception of a few progressive members of Congress, endorsed Lieberman in the primary, post-primary endorsements and Democratic Party money are now backing Lamont. Even though a July poll showed Lieberman handily winning a three-way race against Lamont and a weak Republican candidate, the situation is fluid and seems to be moving in Lamont's direction. One indication is the 14,000 new Democratic voters who registered for the primary, as well as 14,000 independents who switched to the Democratic Party to vote in the primary, the large majority of whom were almost certainly Lamont voters. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Jacob Hacker, a professor of political science at Yale University and co-author of the book Off Center, The Republican Revolution and the Erosion of American Democracy. He talks about Ned Lamont's primary victory as a bellwether of a realignment now taking place in American party politics.
I think that the Lieberman-Lamont race crystallized in many people's minds the Democratic Party's newfound faith in its sort of progressive, more anti-war, more aggressively anti-Bush message. And in many ways, I think that the coming election could be a bit like the 1980 election, when Ronald Reagan swept into office with a bunch of conservative House members who captured the House. You know, we're seeing more and more signs that this could be a tidal wave election. You know, Lieberman was a pretty reliable Democrat. He was very much liked within the party until recently. But in the last few years, there's been a really growing sense of disillusionment with him, not because of his particular stances on issues, with the exception of the war on Iraq, but more because he was seen as being less confrontational, less aggressive than Democrats really wanted in this context. I think it brought to the fore some questions within the Democratic Party that need to be resolved. Where does the party stand on the war? How should the party adapt to the fact that the Republicans have become a much more conservative, much more unified party and have been running Congress really as a one-party show? And what Lieberman said is, you know, the Republican Party is becoming more aggressive and more unified, but we should still play by the old rules. When we agree with the party, we should work with it. When we feel like we can find a compromise that's, you know, a little bit closer to what we believe in, we should try to work for that compromise. I think a lot of Democrats who supported Lamont were saying, if the Republicans are running Congress as a my way or the highway affair, we should be a powerful, unified opposition. And I think in the short term, that's the right approach. I think in the long term, the question is, can the United States regain the sort of center ground in its politics that it had for, you know, two or three decades before the last 15 or 20 years? Can we get back to the vital center, as Arthur Schlesinger famously called it, where our politics is not riven by these really deep party divisions? I think many Democrats would like that, but they feel that right now, that a strategy of centrism, a strategy of compromise, really plays into the hands of a very unified, aggressive Republican Party.
Every 4 years, or even on for House races, every 2 years, the Democrats seem to keep thinking, you know, run to the center, try to capture the center. And there was actually a move-on poll that I read the results of just in the last week that said candidates who took a strong stand, you know, against the Republican leadership and really carved out a position that was clearly different from that, mm-hmm. were held in much higher regard, whereas people who wanted to compromise and sort of mush into the center were considered weak. So it seems like maybe there is a change going on.
I don't think the voters have changed that much. Middle-of-the-road voters have been pretty moderate for over a decade. There was a shift to the right in the electorate in the early 1980s. There was a small shift to the right again in 1994. But after the 1980 elections and after the 1994 midterm elections, when the Republicans captured Congress, voters actually, in the center of the road, voters tended back towards more moderate positions. You know, two times as many Americans report that they're conservative than report that they're liberal. But that number has remained almost rock steady now for 25 years. So I think what's happening in the electorate isn't a shift to the left or right. I think what's happening now is two things. One, we've certainly seen a hardening among voters who identify with one or the other party. Among those voters, there's a sense that there should be a tougher stance, particularly among Democrats, that the party should stand for something, that it should be aggressive unified, set the agenda, not sort of basically follow the lead that's set by the other party. The other change, I think, is a very strong anti-government, anti-incumbent fervor that's risen up again over the last 10 years. And among independent voters is going to be the most important factor in this election. The question today is really, are Republicans, conservatives, going to come out and vote, or are they going to be demobilized in the way that Democrats were in 1994? And the way that the debate has been going, I think there's going to be a very profound demobilization. We've seen that, for example, in fundraising. You know, the Republicans have long had a huge fundraising advantage, but in the last few months, actually, Democrats have done as well as, if not better, than Republicans in raising money. Right after the primary, it was still the case that Lamont was a relative unknown among most voters in Connecticut. It's also the case that for the last few months, the Democratic Party had been lining up behind Lieberman. But now, of course, the entire party is going to line up behind Lamont. Lamont's going to get a lot of money and national endorsements. He's going to run a very aggressive campaign. At the same time, Lieberman is opening himself up to the obvious charge that he's hurting his party and he's engaged in a politics of personal aggrandizement, running on his own. And so I think that will wear badly with the voters, and simultaneously I think that Lamont will gain support and enthusiasm among the voters. I think that if, you know, if I were a betting man, I would say that Lamont will win the election.
That was Jacob Hacker, professor of political science at Yale University and co-author of the book Off Center, The Republican Revolution and the Erosion of American Democracy. The book will be published in paperback in September by Yale University Press. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari. Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is growing and hoping for your membership and participation. www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program.
We'll feature the next segment in our Seabrook Retrospective series, plus some reflection on Hurricane Katrina's impact and mismanagement. We leave you with this quote. The world is a dangerous place to live, not because of the people who are evil, but because of the people who don't do anything about it. Albert Einstein.